Risky Business.
Risky Business.
Risky Business.
Hiya everyone and welcome to Risky Business. I'm Patrick Gray. This week's episode is hosted by Vigabyte Virtual Hosting, but brought to you by Checkpoint Software. If you haven't heard of Checkpoint, then what the hell are you doing listening to this podcast? They've been making security kit since this industry began, for goodness sakes. And thanks again to them for making this week's show possible. Before we get started, you should know that I was at Auscert last week recording my brains out, and figuratively speaking, and I've already posted something like 15 podcasts from the event. There's recorded presentations, interviews, there was the speed debates, which were a real highlight, heaps of fun, and there's, yeah, just heaps of stuff there. So if you want to hear all of our Auscert podcasts, just head to risky.biz/feeds and subscribe to Risky Business 2, and there's just a stack of audio waiting for you there. I hope you enjoy it. Now, I put all the audio into that feed, into the Risky Business 2 feed, because I didn't want to shove 15 extra podcasts down your throats through the regular feed. But as I said, there's some seriously good stuff there, and we'll be adding more content to the Risky Business 2 feed in coming weeks and months. So go subscribe if you want more Risky Business. Now, before we get to the news with Adam Boileau this week, we've got some quick housekeeping to take care of. We will be selecting the winners of our signups drive any day now. I've just been flat out with Auscert preparations and then the audio editing and stuff. I also did a talk there, which was my first conference talk, and it was, pretty hectic getting that ready. But the draw will happen. Just give me another week or two for things to get back to normal, and we will find out who the winners are. How would you like a new job? There's a penetration testing role up for grabs with a Sydney-based security consultancy. They're a small but growing company, and they do a lot of PCI work, application reviews, pen tests, and stuff like that. Now, they are based in Sydney, but they're looking for someone in Melbourne. So if you're a penetration tester and you're open to job offers, or you want to know more about the role or the company, or you know what the money is or whatever, just email me at jobs@risky.biz for more info. Script kiddies need not apply. Sorry, guys. Experienced applicants only. Now, after we do the news, we'll be hearing an interview I did last week with Roelof Temming, who's the creator of Multigo, which is some seriously cool software that you'll probably want to have a play with. And in this week's sponsor interview, Checkpoint Software's Steve McDonald joins us to discuss how vendors are creating specific kit for specific problems, like in all these SCADA firewalls and stuff that are getting around there now, and we'll get his take on whether or not he thinks that's a good trend. But right now, here he is. We all know him, we all love him, and his beautiful, lustrous, soft, soft Unix beard. It's Adam Metalstorm Boileau joining us from a noisier than usual phone line. Sorry about that. And Adam, there is some more O-Day out there affecting Windows. Please tell us what's going on.
Yeah, so this time we've got a bug in Microsoft's QuickTime implementation, it seems, in the DirectShow component of DirectX. And the reports are that it's being actively exploited from inside the browser.
Hooray. So that's the second or third time in recent times that we can think of a zero-day exploit code for Microsoft products circulating. You wouldn't be too happy if you were them.
Well, no. And I guess it shows that the value of these things is now sufficiently high that full disclosure is just not working anymore as a model for security researchers.
Yeah, Microsoft says they are aware of limited active attacks that use this exploit code. If a user is logged on with administrative user rights, an attacker who successfully exploited this vulnerability could take complete control of an affected system. Really? And there is actually a workaround, I believe. They're going to release a patch for the bug as soon as it's ready for broad distribution. In the meantime, you can just basically search around for details of a workaround. There's like a fix-it button that you can click on that sort of mitigates it, which is a good solution for end users, I guess. Anyway, on to the next story, and this is really cool cloak and dagger spy stuff, you know, which is there's been a data breach at the Royal Air Force, which has exposed a lot of flyboys to some pretty nasty blackmail.
Yeah, now this is an interesting story. So apparently what happened is that a bunch of hard disks were misplaced or stolen or otherwise lost. That contained interview data for security clearances, and apparently these were like audio interviews with a whole bunch of personal information. According to the report, extramarital affairs, drug abuse, visits to prostitutes, medical conditions, criminal convictions, and death histories.
All the fun stuff.
Yeah, all the good stuff. And if I was, you know, one of these guys, you know, who'd had these interviews done and now had the recordings, like, man, I would be well pissed.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you can't imagine anything worse, because really what they're doing in those interviews for security clearances is saying, tell us everything that anyone could ever hold against you, and let's just put it on a tape. And, you know, it's gone onto a hard drive for X number of people, and now those hard drives have wandered.
Yeah, this is pretty appalling, man, and I hope some heads will roll in the Ministry of Defence over this, because, I would not be happy.
Yeah, no, certainly I wouldn't either, so I guess we'll watch that story and see if the hard disks turn up. I sincerely hope they do, for the sake of the guys who have their interviews recorded onto those discs. But anyway, next story. This is really kind of funny. I mean, I made a joke recently in an interview with Adam Poynton where we were discussing X10 hacking, that you could rig up a neighborhood so you could play Tetris with the houses, you know, with the lights in the houses in a neighborhood. Now, some guys have put together a video that appears to show people playing Space Invaders on a building, you know, out of the lights in an office building, which is very cool, only it's not a real video, it's a hoax. But the funny thing is, security companies have sort of jumped onto the bandwagon because the video went viral, and they're saying this is proof that SCADA hacking and control systems are vulnerable.
Oh, no, not just proof, it's ominous proof.
Ominous proof.
According to security vendor McGaffey.
Yes.
Our good friend. I mean, seriously, do people think, like, Hollywood movies are real, too? I mean, I watched the video, right? It's fairly obvious to me that it's for amusement and is not actually real. I mean, despite the fact that buildings don't have that level of granularity control, you know, per window lighting. I can't believe that anyone would actually think that was real. Like, it you know, even the style of the movie seems kind of, you know, faux Blair Witch.
Nice.
You know, it doesn't seem very believable to me, and I, you know, it just seems like the marketing department at the security companies being so out of touch with the thing that they're meant to be selling that they fall for it too.
Yeah, I think it's kind of funny, because it wasn't just McAfee, it was a whole bunch, I believe, that sort of got into this and were like, oh, look at this, man, you know, it's SCADA and it's control systems and we're all doomed. And I think it was Wired who wrote it up. Yeah, it was Kevin Poulsen at Wired. Who wrote it up as viral video hoax or proof of impending cyber apocalypse. You've got to give him props for the headline. That's pretty cool. On to the next piece. And apparently, according to Message Labs, who I don't know if they're in a great position to know because all of their customers get spammed a lot, which is why they buy their service. But according to Message Labs, 90% of all email is spam.
Well, yeah, and as you say, anti-spam vendors, like, this is, it's their business to say that, and indeed, they see, as you suggest, a lot of spam. Mm. Although I did notice that it's, according to Message Labs, it is a disturbing trend, not just a trend, a disturbing trend.
Disturbing trend by our
service. Ominous and disturbing trend.
Yeah, I think it's very interesting, actually, that this is what it's come to, and I think the days when you can actually get away with not using any form of spam protection, they were over a couple of years ago. Do you agree?
Yeah, exactly. And everyone is running some kind of anti-spam solution already, so people don't get 90% of spam in their message box. So
yeah.
Is it really meaningful for us to say, well, you know, it's 90% of email, but my inbox has, you know, 30% spam, right? That's, in terms of end-user effect, right, does it really matter if the bulk of email is 90% of spam if all I see is 30%?
Yeah, but I still think it's interesting that even if you look at it from an SMTP, you know, processing point of view, that 90% of email is actually spam going through mail servers. I still think that's a kind of a, you know, pretty out there stat.
It's a concern. If you're doing resource management for, you know, mail systems and large ISPs, it does make you care about it. But on the other hand, I you know, I don't know that spam is a problem that's going to go away. I mean, filtering technologies or whatever are always going to be in an arms race with the spammers. And I mean, this is a, you know, this is a demand side problem.
Well, it's interesting that, because I don't know that there is as much demand for spam these days. Well, I mean, you know, it's quite ironic, isn't it, talking about demand for spam. But, you know, at the end of the day, these guys wouldn't do it if people didn't buy stuff. But I saw statistics that said something like only 1 in 14 million messages results in a click-through, and of them, something like 99.9% of them are people who accidentally click on the link. And, you know, if you're talking about volumes of billions of messages, that's not too unreasonable to believe. You know, 1 in 14 million might get clicked on accidentally. And then in terms of a purchase, I think, yeah, it's like maybe 1 in 100 of them actually results in a purchase. So these guys have to send something like, you know, 1.4 billion messages to sell a little bottle of fake Cialis.
Yeah, but I mean, on the other hand, there's still someone buying. And even if we were to try and solve this on the other end, like by making you pay per email, right, they're using stolen machines anyway. They're using botnets and other people's compromised systems to send the mail. So we can't really increase the cost to them of sending the mail. And the only way to solve it is demand side.
No, I agree with you. But what I'm saying is I can't believe that the current level of purchase interaction with, you know, with spam is actually enough to justify doing it in the first place. I just can't believe it.
They wouldn't be doing it. I mean, maybe you should find some spammers and interview them.
It's not a bad idea. Ask them for their latest techniques and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, this is the Risky Biz call for spammers. Yeah, it'll be rocking.
That could be good. All right, we better move on. There is a bug in OpenSSH that doesn't look, it looks like something you'd want to patch, but it doesn't look incredibly serious. Can you tell us a little bit more about this bug?
Yeah, so there was some guys doing research into the cryptography used in OpenSSH, and they found a weakness whereby you, if you can get in the middle of an SSH connection, you have effectively a 1 in 260k chance of recovering 32 bits of the contents, or the unencrypted contents of the SSH session. And I mean, yes, this is a cryptographic weakness, and yes, it's good that people have found it and that it's going to get patched. The interesting thing, though, and I think that, you know, OpenSSH is a very high-profile target, and if you're going to do cryptographic research and you wanted to make a name for yourself, then making sure that your research results affect something like OpenSSL or OpenSSH is a very good way to get media coverage. And I actually talked to Peter Goodman last week about this particular bug, and he said, look, this is, from a cryptographic research point of view, this is not a particularly interesting bug, and really that, you know, the fact that they targeted OpenSSH with it was just to get attention, to make sure that they got media coverage, and that, you know, he didn't think that it was a particularly practical thing in the real world. And I'm inclined to agree.
And next up, we've actually got a news piece pulled off our very own site, risky.biz, written by yours truly. I did an interview with Kimberly Zenz of iDefense while I was at AusCert. And as it turns out, there's a lot of guys using stolen UK credit card data in Australia because we haven't rolled out EMV yet.
You know, I suppose this is interesting, isn't it? Like the internet, you know, connects everybody, but also allows criminals to do, you know, separate their bits, the portions of their crime using the same technology, and that's kind of cool. Australia and probably also New Zealand needs to step up its game and you know, get with the world standards. You know, we're not in the antipodes anymore.
Yeah, so basically the UK card data is stolen, but it can't really be exploited there because they all expect that the user has the EMV sort of extended authentication, you know, fancy chippy card thingy with their little EMV device as well. So they just bring the card data out to Australia. It's not unreasonable to expect UK data would be actually used or UK cards would be used in Australia. There's strong cultural ties between Australia and the UK. And a lot of Brits come out here for holidays. So it's not really that unusual to assume that those transactions would happen. And yeah, they're making an absolute fortune out of it from what I hear. And a couple of the card issuers have hit the roof over this.
Yeah, well, I suppose it's, you know, it's a classic example of attacking where your enemy is weak.
Yeah, that's right. Hit them where they're weak, not where they're strong. That doesn't make sense. All right, Adam, well, that's actually the end of the news for this week. Thanks, mate, for coming back onto the show, and we'll chat again soon.
Not a problem, man. Talk to you later.
Our good friend Adam Metalstorm Boileau on the line from New Zealand there with a look at the week's news headlines. Now it's time for this week's feature interview with Perturva's very own Rulif Temming. Now, Rulif is the creator of Multigo, which is a very cool bit of software that basically takes information from various sources, correlates it, and then displays it in a pretty picture. So you can take a domain name, bung it into Multigo, and then run what they call a transform on it. So you might find something like the email address in the Whois information for that domain. So, okay, that's a Whois. So what? Well, The good stuff is when you start going beyond that, and then you can take like that email and find out which sites the email address appears on to see if there's any correlation. Then you can do other stuff with other transforms, like looking at what IP addresses are associated with those hosts, what networks are they on, who owns those networks, what other hosts are located in the network, which of those hosts are on the same IPs, which are on different IPs, which of the network owners share phone numbers, and how many of the email addresses found on the sites are located on social networks. So within a couple of hours, you'll be digging up all sorts of weird stuff after just starting with one query on a domain name. And as I said, it draws pretty pictures. So you get this nice visual representation of associations between different bits of data. It's very cool, but it's a little bit difficult to explain. I've tried to do my best there. But I guess the simplest way of explaining it is it takes publicly available information, lets you mine that information, and then gives you ways of making sense of the correlation between bits of that information. So I spoke to Roelof shortly after his presentation at OSCERT's security conference last week and asked him to tell us more about Multigo and its uses.
The thing that you got to understand what this thing does is something that I said in the presentation as well. Is if you think about a web browser, a browser really navigates websites, and the websites are linked by links that's on the website. Now, imagine you don't only have websites, but you have lots of other things as well. You have people, you have documents, you have ASN, you have whatever. And they can link to any of the other things again. And the link between them is either kind of a hard link and a man-made link, or it's a soft and fluffy link. So I'll give you an example. So a DNS name and an IP address are linked because they resolve, the DNS name resolves to an IP address or IP addresses. And that is a man-made link that was made by whoever created the zone. But some of the links are not that strong. So, for instance, if your email address and your telephone number appears in the same close approximation to each other, then when I look up your telephone number, I might see your email address, right? When you do it on a search engine. Mm. And the tool does the same kind of thing. And then it would say, well, this email address is linked to that telephone number. But it doesn't know why. It can't tell you that it is the same person. So you got to see if that result that you got actually verifies. You understand what I'm saying?
I do.
And that's a kind of a fuzzy link. There's also the
IP address that the domain name resolves to might be on a particular net block owned by a certain organization that might have an office down the street from the dry cleaner of the person. And
absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, exactly. I mean, you get a situation where guys make wild assumptions based on the results that they see in Multigo. Mm. But you always got to understand the process behind it, so that you can give context to your results.
So before you get excited about having just found Bin Laden.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. You maybe need to sit down and have a cup of tea.
Yeah. And just see if it really, pans out the way you think. If it's a hard link. So some of the other things that we do, for instance, is we have ways that this can integrate with more structured data, like SQL databases. Now, then it becomes interesting because then that data is already kind of hard linked in some way.
It's already based on a structured association, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, it depends on whoever got that database, where they got the data from. Mm. But let's say it is a telephone directory. Well, then it's awesome because then it means all the links are now nice hard links, and you can rely on the information that you have to be absolutely correct. And you understand how that information was obtained in the first place, because you've got the database, so you should kind of know. But on the internet, the stuff is not that nicely connected. It's not. There's no guarantees either. There's no context to the stuff either. So you have to be very careful that you don't jump to conclusions, because Multigo links two pieces of information together.
Well, it seems to be a very popular tool among IT security professionals. What are they using this tool for? Is it more your typical network analysis sort of stuff, or are they getting into some of this higher level, looking at people, looking at organizational links and stuff like that? How is it being used by the typical security consultant?
A lot of guys use it for footprinting, but we've at Black Hat Amsterdam, we've now released, you'd see it on the forum as well, like transforms that integrate on a local with local transforms with Nmap and with Nessus. So you could use it as, like, you know, footprint the organization, right click, scan.
Autoprone, okay. Yeah.
You know, well, that's the interesting thing. So a lot of people said to us, well, come on, integrate Metasploit into this. And I was like, you know, I want to get away from this thing for being this
security tool.
Well, yeah, a security tool and this hacking tool, right? But so the guys are using it for the more kind of traditional stuff. But also what we find is that some consultants would be using it as the reconnaissance stage for, you know, social engineering.
Yeah, I was just thinking this would – it strikes me as a really good use for it, is if you can find out that the guy who admins the firewall at your target happens to be the chair of the Kiddlywink soccer team in X suburb, you know, you might have some very nice vectors there for finding out what people do that isn't necessarily connected to their organization, finding out where their personal network extends to. Am I sort of on the right?
Yeah, for sure. Mm. One of the examples that I gave in the talk was, if you take an agency, let's say kind of a sensitive agency, and you say, find me all the telephone numbers that are connected to this domain where they sit, you can kind of see that a lot of the numbers look the same because they start with the same digits. So you could make the assumption, again, this is assumption, right? You can make the assumption that says, well, this is an exchange, so all doesn't matter what the last four numbers are, it's all at that particular agency. And then it starts to become interesting because now you can say, well, let's search for those starting numbers, and the last four digits could be, you know, random. Then we get all the information that we get back from the search engine, and we parse all of that for email addresses. And it kind of works. You get then all the agency email addresses, which is not like the most interesting part. But you also get the email addresses that the guy would put down when he's selling his garden furniture, and he puts down his.
I love owning the CIA because they're doing private listings for lawn furniture. By the way, that's beautiful. But please continue.
I'm not necessarily disclosing, but I mean the thing is then what they do is they sell, let's say in a private capacity, something. They put their Yahoo email address in there, but their work phone number. And now you have something interesting because now you can mine that information for their private email addresses. And I mean, I'm pretty sure that those guys have, you know, content filters that's mad on the official looking email, but when they get back home and they switch on the notebook or whatever it is,
and you happen to send them a Word or PDF file that says, hey, I'm really interested in some lawn furniture.
Oh.
Yeah.
So, you know, you never know where that ends up. So that's kind of the thing that I think is interesting for security people, but on both sides of the fence. So, you know, it's something I think you should be looking at, what kind of information is out there, and not just first-order information, but like second-order information as well, which means, you know, what is then connected, for instance, that email address that you find there, is that connected to a social network? And if it is, let's say that email address is registered on a social network, who's the friends? Mm. So now you start moving away from the kind of confined boundaries of...
Well, and then you can start looking at associations from the friends of that person. I mean, if there's a particularly sensitive association, they're not exactly going to be Facebook buddies, but you might be able to find other less direct connections by examining that social network.
Yeah. Or you can say, let's say you have two people, you want to link two people, you can say, okay, and let's
assume
that
the Kevin Bacon game, we call it.
Absolutely. Yeah. The problem that you have with that, and remember now, it gets really interesting.
Well, this is the problem, is you can connect everyone to Kevin Bacon, so.
that's the thing.
Yes.
What you need to keep in mind here as well is that we're not just dealing with one type of information. In the Kevin Bacon game, you link by actors and movies. Mm. So that would be one transform that says, what movie did you play in and what actors was in that movie? So that's okay, it's two transforms, right? And I actually did it hooking into the IMDb for that kind of thing. Mm. But the point is, now we're not only linking on with two transforms. We've got 195 transforms that are that can link these things real quick. So, for instance, if you were to put a Gmail address, abc@xyz@gmail.com, and you would select both and you run old transforms on both of them, they will immediately link because they're both at Gmail.
Yeah.
I've done kind of experimental stuff by taking completely separate phrases and say, okay, run all transforms on this and run all transforms on this. Then take the result and run all transforms on this again. It gets really kind of mad. But very quick stuff links to Microsoft, Google, and who's the guys that make Acrobat? Adobe.
Adobe, yeah.
Yeah, because they everywhere.
Yeah.
And it's kind of weird to see it. I mean, they go, goes into these sites because everybody's got a little button on their website to say, if you want to view my PDFs, then download this here. And that gets, the site gets mirrored, the link gets pulled, and that's a link out from that site. And the other guy's got the same link. And all of a sudden, they linked. So I think the trick here is then to understand what it is you're doing and to decide which transforms to run for the kind of information that you think you want.
And it's not even about finding the information that you're looking for. It's about finding the correct types of associations between different types of data that you're trying to connect.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Look, on that note, Rolf Temming, thank you very much for your time.
Yeah. Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Rolf Temming, as interviewed at Auscert's 2009 conference there. As I said, for more of the Auscert content, subscribe to Risky Business 2 at risky.biz/feeds. And there's a 10-minute excerpt from Rolf's conference talk up there where he's talking about different stuff to what we just discussed in that interview. Now, next up, it's time for this week's sponsor interview. And during Auscert, I had a very interesting chat with XS4All's Scott McIntyre about VoIP fraud. Again, you can find that in the RB2 feed. But it got me thinking, like VoIP systems and others face very specific threats, and we're starting to see more and more VoIP systems being deployed in homes everywhere. So people are starting to run Asterisk at home. Are vendors tempted to try to address these risks with specific bits of kit, and is that a good approach? So think of SCADA kit. We're hearing, you know, a lot of vendors and stuff starting to come out and say they've got SCADA firewalls these days. But as you hear Steve himself, who works for a firewall vendor, is a little bit skeptical about designing, I suppose, what you call idiot-proof kit that you just drop and forget. You know, he argues the problems are too complicated to be solved through the deployment of a border device or just a protocol sanity checker.
First of all, I don't think there's any such thing as an idiot-proof gateway. Idiots are quite resourceful when they need to, there's no question. But looking at specifically the home user with their Asterisk box, then we've got to start looking at maybe that security needs to be integrated with the connectivity layer within the home. It's unlikely that I'm going to go with an open source PBX solution at home to then go and spend another $500 on a security gateway specifically to protect that.
Mm. Yeah, what are you likely to do, actually? I mean, that's a question. You're more likely just to try to configure your equipment to be secure in the first place, aren't you? And just sort of rely on it rather than extra solutions.
Well, that's what you're going to hope to do. But, I mean, you still drive around and see a lot of open wireless access points. And I understand there's a large divide between the person who's sitting at home with a unprotected wireless access point and somebody who's installed Asterisk. But over the next 5 years, maybe that divide will not be so great. So you've got to look at specifically that area of the market. It's probably very exposed moving forward.
Well, let's have a look at SCADA, though. Have you guys got all sorts of plugins and stuff that you put into your firewall that are designed to filter certain types of SCADA commands and things like that and keep an eye on stuff? Or do you just rely on your firewall more as a port blocker?
Well, look, we have some capabilities in the product set, specifically around Modbus, looking at the various policies that can be implemented there and looking at making sure that only specific command sequences are sent, that's any command sequences that are sent within specific ranges. And I guess one thing that we don't really do then is link that back in with the back-end command and control system to automate the provisioning of that. But there's capabilities within the product sets to look at that in more detail. But once again, it's an interesting issue there because straight away, we're dealing with people who have an attitude generally that with the SCADA networks, because you can't touch it, in the good words of our friend MC Hammer, you look at the physical aspects, they believe that these boxes are physically secured, then they believe that they're disconnected from the network, and then finally, there's the obscurity angle comes up where we've got proprietary systems private designs, private protocols, all lead to a security blanket that maybe is not as thick as people might like to think, given the importance of these networks.
Yeah, and I guess the other thing too with proprietary protocols is you can't really build a standard filter for those sorts of things, can you? I mean, there's nothing that you can get to plug into your checkpointy, fancy, shiny thingy with lights that's going to protect you against some sort of bogus or nasty, horrible command to some bit of proprietary SCADA kit.
And that's where the infrastructure industries have been leading the way in trying to take proactive steps and move this forward. But once again, you look at the cost of securing a SCADA network because of its geographically dispersed nature and the amount of individual points that could be circumvented. I mean, let's consider people who might have grown up exploring their own urban stormwater drains now would probably think that getting access to a pump, you know, as part of the national infrastructure that controls a key gas line is interesting. But once again, that side of the security and being able to plug a checkpoint device or something else into that side of the network, you know, is interesting. But at the end of the day, these pumps take their orders from controllers, and the controllers get their information from databases. And you've got to look at where you're more effective, depending on the outcome you want, and whether you're just a stormwater person or whether you're actually some form of terrorist or other government organization. Where are you going to attack first?
Look, let me ask you this. If you think, if we see a vendor out there claiming to sell, you know, a bit of kit that is designed for SCADA security and it will lock down your SCADA networks, should we be quite skeptical of that? Do you believe? And I've asked other people this, but I'm curious to see what you have to say, you know, as you do represent a vendor.
Look, I honestly think there are too many areas of security, specifically in the SCADA environment, to have the concept of one box protecting all the various attack possibilities in that type of network is possibly a little bit overstating. The other side to it is you've got to look at it. You've got an engineer who'll go into a control room or perhaps do some kind of field service on this equipment. He or she is carrying a laptop, probably with a mobile data card, getting unfettered access to all of the equipment. How do you protect against, you know, this attack from within possibility, being able to just drop in a small embedded Linux operating system with a 3G connection and have your own phone on the inside rather than on the outside?
And I guess you've got to worry also then about the whole issue of being able to provision access to field, you know, to service workers and things like that, which isn't something you normally hear a lot about in the discussion around SCADA.
Yep, absolutely. And throughout all of this, we need to keep in mind that a self-denial of service on these kind of infrastructure components could be potentially disastrous.
Yay. Well, mate, I guess that brings us back to one simple little fact that just won't go away, which is there is no easy solution to a lot of this stuff. But Steve McDonald, thank you very much for joining us on Risky Business again this week.
Thank you, Patrick.
Steve McDonald from Checkpoint Software there, rounding out this week's edition of the Risky Business Podcast. If you have some feedback on this week's show, please call Sydney 02-8569 1835 or USA 877-688-8417, and that's a toll-free number. Please leave a message and we may play your audio in next week's show. Taking us out this week is a fantastic tune by Dan and Al, a legendary Melbourne-based guitar and songwriting duo. I've got no idea if these guys still gig. But this song is called Door to Door, and it's from the album Isle of Hop, and you can still buy it at danwarnermusic.com, and it's a nice album. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.
When you left for Sydney, a broken shell remained. These empty halls from door to door were twisted like a maze. And now the locks are open, the planets realign, and nothing really matters, cause she's coming home now. She's coming home tonight. in the rubbish, hang your long face on the line, an ice pack on your heart that's cracked. She's coming home tonight. A broken promise in the kettle, the steam will carry it away. I leave a dream lit on the doorstep. She's coming home to stay. Yeah, she's coming home. She's coming home tonight. Yeah, she's coming home. She's coming home tonight.